So I got nothing new on the writing front to tell you guys about tonight. The new project is expanding plot-wise, character-wise, exponentially, which is fun. But before I give a deep dive into what I got going on, I got to dial a couple things in. I'm gonna hold off on giving you any more on the new project. Sci-fi space, gonna be fun, but it's getting complicated. Before I get started though, you guys seem pretty happy with Ty and Overmatch so far. A lot of good comments on Billie West. I'm really glad that you guys like her because as I plot out where Ty is going, I want Billie to be a part of it. So I'm really glad that you like her because if you didn't, it would really send me back to the drawing board on books 3 and 4. So I appreciate that. And if you haven't done so already, go pick yourself up a coffee and also Blood Red Ivory makes a great bundle for those two. Just that is it. That's all the selling I'm going to do. I can't stand doing that stuff anyway. I do have one confession to make before I introduce who we're talking to tonight. Last week, the fam and I went to Orlando for spring break. And while I am very proud to say I did not once step foot in a theme park, I unfortunately did manage to get all my family, including the 6-year-old, hooked on escape rooms. I had planned on doing one. We ended up doing three. Because we lost the first one, we were all the competitive spirit, which I'm very proud to see throughout my family, would not refuse to give up until we won. So we did another one and we won the third one. So we went 2 out of 3, which was not bad for our rookie season. Unfortunately, the side effect though is my wife is now scouring Georgia for the next place we're going to do an escape room. I did not see that coming. And also what I didn't see coming is once the clock starts winding down in those places, she gets real assertive, like take charge, nurse when the code goes blue, assertive. It was honestly pretty hot. So thank you very much, Escapeology. We will be back. And if you're in Orlando, you should probably hit up Escapeology on International Drive. Scooby-Doo, Star Trek, and forgot what the third one was, but it was awesome either way. And you did hear that correct. I managed to go a week in Orlando and I did not have to go to a theme park once, which was pretty freaking awesome, if you ask me. But enough about me. Tonight, I get to talk to Alana Berry. Alana Berry spent 6 years as an operations officer for the CIA, serving in wartime Baghdad and elsewhere. She has lived and worked throughout Europe and the Middle East, including 2 years in Bahrain during the Arab Spring. She's a graduate of the University of Virginia School of Law and Haverford College. Raised in the suburbs of Washington, she now lives in Virginia with her husband and son. Her new book that we're going to talk about, I'm very excited, The Peacock and the Sparrow, follows a world-weary CIA spy as he uncovers and unravels different conspiracies and undercurrents that are feeding the Arab Spring. Walks right through the consequences of one person's actions and what can be a have geo worldwide consequences. It was a fantastic book. And Alana, thank you very much for coming to join me.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored.
Well, thank you.
I enjoyed listening to your description of Orlando, and I'm impressed that you didn't go to Disney or anything.
You know, I never thought in the world that I would be able to make it without going to a theme park. And when it came up, it was like our spring break was weird this year. We were supposed to go originally. I wanted to take the family out to the Desert Southwest just to show them, a different part of America. And I want to do that throughout the different regions. And for different scheduling reasons, work-wise, school-wise, it didn't work out. We were going to go to Puerto Rico next, and that didn't work out. So we kept kind of bouncing, and finally we were like, all right, let's hit Orlando. And if anything, I was like, my kids are 11 and 6. So I was like, if I have to do a theme park, I'll take them to Legoland because that place
Oh,
is the most stress-free.
I'm familiar with Legoland. I've taken my son when he was younger. We went all the time.
Yeah, it's so stress-free. Like you just turn those kids loose and you're good to go. And so I was like, maybe I can do that. And it didn't even come up. It was like, oh
No.
yeah. So we just hung out on International Drive for a week, just chilling. I was like, man, that's how to do it. But I was like, I don't have to go to Disney or Universal. This is amazing.
Nice.
No lines. Yeah.
Nice.
So it was very cool. Not a bad way to spend spring break if you can't be in Hawaii or something. But
Yes.
But yeah, the we were talking a little bit before we started, and we could jump right into the Peacock and the Sparrow. But you know, when I first started reading and I looked at your background, that intelligence world kind of fascinates me. And I remember when I was in the FBI Academy and we're getting our block on counterintelligence, and the way that the instructor, he was fantastic instructor, and he just went about just laying out the difference between the law enforcement world and the intelligence world.
Yes.
And it seemed so intricate and so strategic in scope. But also at the same time, I came from working narcotics and it was all source work. And it was just the two, it seemed like those two things kind of married up quite a bit. And I've always found it fascinating. So I guess if you could tell us kind of what your background a little.
I think that's true. I think there is a lot of overlap. I think the big difference, you can tell me too, is, you know, the FBI, you're really governed by so many laws. And of course you are in the CIA too, but your fundamental job is sort of to break the law overseas, you know, which is to, you know, to convince someone to betray their country. So I think, you know, that's a big difference in sort of the mindset and the psyche of a, you know, a case officer maybe versus like an FBI agent. I don't know, you might be able to speak to that, but that's one difference. And also I think CIA, you're dealing with really overseas international issues. That's really the bread and butter. And of course the FBI is more domestic threats.
Yeah. And I think it is, you know, it's well, much needed. And it goes to security of the American people when we do have those executive orders that govern the intelligence work on the domestic side. And that FBI's mission is counterintelligence, which is much more important. You know, again, if we all take the oath to uphold and defend the Constitution, and if we can uphold those Bill of Rights, the Fourth and Fifth, you know, that's the biggest part of our job. But yeah, what got me was really, when you boil it down to it, was that source work, you know, just the ability to build relationships with people.
Absolutely.
It's just such a creative endeavor. I mean, it's a stressful endeavor, but it's just the creativity of influencing people in that way, especially in the high stress stakes that, like you said, on the international side, you're convincing people to do things that will put them in harm's way, which is whole different level. Working dope, you put people in harm's way, but you know, they usually live that life anyway. You know?
Yeah, no, true. Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. And I think what both professions share is you have to build up that relationship of trust, you know, with your source, with your informant. And it really comes down to the human factor, as Graham Greene called it. He wrote a book called The Human Factor. And I think that to me, that's the most interesting part of the world, is those relationships that you develop, you know.
Yeah, did you have that understanding, like that it all came down to relationships before you went into that career, or was it something you had to learn on the fly?
That's a really good question. You know, I think I knew at an abstract level, but I think I didn't really understand what that meant. And to be honest, I felt like it was a lot more manipulation than I had anticipated. You know, I didn't realize that you really have to convince someone to do something that they wouldn't otherwise do. And, you know, you're constantly trying to persuade people to do these dangerous things that affect their lives. And I think it took a toll on me. I think that kind of came out in my book. And I didn't realize it would have that kind of visceral effect on me. I mean, I remember there was one operation in Baghdad where I was developing a potential source. She was a woman. There weren't that many women there. And she was going through a divorce, and I was meeting with her for lunch, and she wanted to show me some pictures on her phone of her husband's mistress that he had an affair with. And that was kind of the cause of the divorce. And she was basically just looking for a shoulder to cry on. And I'm sitting there, you know, looking at these pictures, thinking, how can I use this? You know, how can I use this in our, to our advantage? And it's what you have to do as a spy, but it's kind of an icky thing. You know, it's not, it doesn't come naturally. Some people, I think it does. It didn't come naturally for me. So I don't think I was fully prepared. I understood it at an intellectual level, but I don't think I understood it fully in practice.
Yeah. And I asked that question. Yeah. Cause it's, you know, we talked about what I saw as great parallels, between the source work of a narcotics investigator and the intelligence side of the world. But yeah, that's something I never really considered, because you know, in the narcotics world, most of the time you hook a guy up and suddenly he's your source, or, you know, it's not often that you have a good Samaritan that's like suddenly, you know, wants to be a vigilante and clean up the streets, and you're putting a good person in harm's way. It's usually they've done something to get themselves there, and they gotta work off the hook. That kind of influence, I could see that wearing on a person.
It does, here and there. I think. Yeah. What's the typical timeline for counter narcotics in the FBI? How long does it take to kind of develop a source?
It depends. It can be. It depends. If you're going for a clean source, like you know, like somebody just with, you know, access, or somebody without a criminal history, something like that, you've got to go through the rapport building and the grooming, and so to speak. But that's very rare. Most of the time, it's a business negotiation. I just caught you with an ounce. Now I want you to go get me ounces, and I don't care how you do it. But you're either going to work, or I'm just going to take you to jail. And it's just, and it's usually with the people, it's very seldom that you run into a straight rookie who's this is my first, I can't believe this happened, this is my first time. It's like, that's not how it works. Your rap sheet's probably 6 feet long by the time you're 15. It's like, this is a business negotiation. You're going to sell out your buddy this week, and your buddy's going to sell you out next week. And it's a vicious cycle. Right. So I wondered about that, just cause man, that's complicated.
And it sounds like, you know, it sounds like the timeline for FBI or counter narcotics is a lot shorter. I mean, typically at the agency, you'd be developing a source for months, maybe even year plus.
Yeah.
It was a little different when I was in Baghdad for a year, and it was a war zone. So it was a little different. You weren't out like schmoozing and playing tennis and, you know, for months on end. It wasn't like a peacetime country that way. So we did rely a lot on walk-ins, and we did have short recruitment cycles. So it was a little different, but generally speaking, I think it sounds like it's a long.
I had some buddies that worked the JCIU over there, and were in, you know, intelligence, counterintelligence roles in different ways. And I was, you know, the vetting, that, you know, because part of that cycle is making sure the person you're talking to isn't going to, you know, try to betray you. So you're already in a war zone, and you're working on a shortened cycle because it's so time sensitive often. It seems like the risk has got to be so much more amplified.
100%. I mean, that was absolutely what I took from Baghdad, was just the fog of war and espionage. And you have to make these decisions in this world where nothing is clear. You know, you have to make snap decisions. Is this guy telling the truth? You know, is this a plant? I mean, I had one instance where a guy claimed he knew a middleman who was selling explosives. And to prove it, he was going to bring a small quantity of explosives in to show me into the green zone. So I was going to meet him outside and escort him in, because, of course, you can't bring explosives into the green zone.
And, hopefully not.
Well, that's the thing. So somehow there was miscommunication, and next thing I know, I'm waiting outside for him outside the green zone, and I get a call, and he's like, "Well, where are you? I'm inside." And I go inside, and sure enough, he'd gotten through the guards, he'd gotten through the dogs. he basically, every level of security had failed. He had the explosives with him. He'd gotten into the green zone. And then I had to kind of think on my feet and think, and I made up a story. I was like, "Oh, well, you know, lucky for you, we told the guards you were coming." So,
right.
Cause I'm like, but my point is, like, I'm thinking, was this deliberate? Like, is this guy a plant? I mean, what, what just happened here? You know, was this, did we just, was it an accident and all the security failed? Or was this part of a plan to test the security of the green zone? But those are the kind of questions that you're constantly thinking about, and you don't know if you're making the right decisions, and you don't know if people are telling the truth and who you can trust. So that was sort of what haunted me. And I think that was what prompted the peacock and the sparrow.
Yeah. And every, as you say that, everything you say is just boiled down so well in the peacock and the sparrow. Cause it's like the whole time you've got this mix of people. And like you say, it feels like a fog most of the time. Like everybody's got their own, I don't know if I call them demons or if I call them just weight of
for sure.
A slog of a life. And, and nobody tells anybody the truth the entire time. Everybody's shady. Like you just said.
Yes.
And, exactly. And you could feel that all the way through that book. It was just, I guess
that was my goal. There's always a story behind the story, right? You know, I feel like that's also was sort of my point, you know, especially I lived in Bahrain during the Arab Spring, and I realized that the story was so much more, that the conflict was so much more complex than people realized. You know, on the surface, you have a legitimate democratic movement against a lot of these dictatorships, and it is a legitimate democratic movement. But in Bahrain, you have Saudi Arabia backing the monarchy, and you have Iran giving, to some degree, support to these revolutionaries. And that really complicates the conflict, because now you have a kind of proxy war in these two superpowers, and suddenly Iran's involved, and it's not so easy for the US to support this otherwise democratic movement, at least in Bahrain. So I think my point with that was just that there's always more to the story. You know, take the Middle East, take what's going on now, or almost anywhere. There's so many layers to these conflicts, and I think as a spy, you're really in the thick of it. So to me, the Arab Spring was kind of the perfect lens for showing that ambiguity and that grayness of espionage.
Yeah, and like I said before we started recording it, it's it was like a literal, like I said, it was like a breath of fresh air, because it was. People say slow burn whenever they talk about like a new Netflix series, and I wouldn't call it a slow burn. It felt more like the blinds are just opened on a window, and you get to jump into Shane Collins's life and just see how a spy lives with something like this blowing up in his face. Like, what did he have, like two or three guys on the station, and they're just pretty much filing paperwork and checking boxes, waiting for their time, and then kablooey. It's like, oh, well, I guess we got to deal with this now. Like, and it's yours. This is your problem.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. No, thank you for saying that. Yeah. I mean, that was sort of my goal. I didn't want to, you know, make it a typical spy novel where they're just bullets right off the bat, you know, and as you said, you know, murders in the first 10 pages or something. Yeah. I wanted it a little more realistic.
When I started it, I went in with the idea after the first 10 or 15 pages, I'm like, okay, this is going to be like Jack Ryan as the analyst, you know, before he starts saving the world as an analyst. It was like, okay, this is going to be a very strategic thought process of how to build evidence and how to make assumptions, verify and corroborate and, you know, strategically win this problem. And then it shifted into more feeling like, oh man, who's the guy who wrote LA Confidential and Black Dahlia? Elroy.
James Elroy.
It felt more like a James.
I love him.
I do too. Like LA Confidential and Black Dahlia are on my 11-year-old's reading list for when he's 15. Like it's already built. Like,
15 is like my, I know that's what I say is the age where you can start reading the really dark stuff. I told my son he can read my book when he's 15. So
yeah. My 6-year-old the other day, he picks up one and he's like, I want to read this. Can I read this? I'm like, no, I'm a really bad parent when it comes to this, but no.
I know. I don't want to say. My son's school actually asked if I wanted to come in and read for my book, and he's in 8th grade. And I was like, "Oh, I'm so flattered, but I don't know if I should read from my book to the 8th graders."
Where would I start? The end? Okay. Here, the end.
Right.
That's it. That's the only thing I can read for you. So it's So we're in Bahrain and the world just blows up and suddenly it's in these guys' lap. And it's as we get to know them, they all Colin's hiding a bunch of stuff. Jimmy's got his thing going on.
Yes.
The Whitney, the Weasley little, like I can see, like, I think everybody who's been in government has a bureaucrat like Whitney in his,
100%. I get that from so many people. And by the way, of all the characters, they're kind of composites of people, but Whitney is based on a real person. So
I can see him. I can right? absolutely.
We've known one.
Yep. I think I've had somebody yell at me about my equivalent of TPS reports who just, that's Whitney. There he is. Uh-huh. That's my guy. Uh-huh. That led to my question is like, did you have faces for all these characters? But yeah, you've got composites all except this guy.
Yeah. And the expat community was based on real people too. A lot of the characters were directly based on people I knew, and the dialogue was actually based on actual conversations. I was like, I just can't make stuff up that's as good as what I heard. Yeah. I mean, just people saying, you know, oh, in this country, you know, you can wear whatever you want because you can wear luxury goods, which was ridiculous.
Yeah.
And just kind of the petty conversations. And you know, there are a couple scenes where expats are sort of watching the conflict from afar. They're watching from their roof decks and they're sipping champagne and they're very removed in both a literal and a metaphoric sense. You know, it's like the conflict isn't real to them. It's something that these locals have to deal with and they're protected. And that was actually based on real life too. I mean, there were constant kind of riots and skirmishes when I was there, and there were expats who would sit and watch it from their roof decks. And I was like, this is just too perfect. I had to put that in the book. It was just such a metaphor.
This is bizarro land. It's like the people who packed picnics and went and watched Antietam, you know,
right, the right, exactly.
Civil War. Yeah. What are we going to do today? We're going to go watch people kill each other from a hilltop.
Exactly. It's this sort of insularity and privilege. Yeah.
Yeah. And as I was reading that, like I only spent a little, I didn't spend a whole bunch of time in that overseas, but when I did, it kind of reminded me a little bit of the quirkiness of the contractor community, like the civilians, we civilians that would accompany like at Lemanye in Djibouti or in, I did some time in the Neck in Baghdad, but that civilian expeditionary group was, there was a quirkiness, an individuality to that group of people that it didn't come across in quite the same ways. Like I could see what you were doing with that group of people you're talking about, but yeah, that's there's an individualness that goes along with those groups that just go off to, you know, we leave America and we go over to these tiny little points. And but yeah, the same thing I would notice just in my travels would that same kind of they remove themselves from the problems. Yeah. And it's like, have you guys ever read history? Like, you know, people were fleeing Vietnam in Hueys from our roof, like. In some circumstances, we're not that far from that in places. Like it's really not.
Right.
It's not a stretch. Like especially during like the Arab Spring.
Yeah.
I remember friends were there. Their families either couldn't go or their families were evacuated at some point when Bahrain. They, you know, people who were stationed at Bahrain with NCIS, it turned away from being an accompanied tour to an independent tour because of those kind of threats and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's so true. And it's funny because every now and then I get someone who says, you know, I don't want to give away the ending, but who says, oh, well, the ending wouldn't have happened that way, you know, wouldn't have happened that quickly. And I'm thinking, really? Like, because in my experience, that's exactly what happens. I mean, you name it, look at what happened in Afghanistan or, you know, Vietnam or, you know, any number of places.
You know, yeah, it just devolves. Yeah, it's just history. I mean, you can say it's not going to happen to me all you want, but this is it, you can't have the American, you know, not in my backyard, mindset when you're in somebody else's backyard where that can very easily happen. Right.
And I think just revolutions can happen like that. And people don't realize that. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is the scope is not even close, but I remember, I was in Djibouti and I was running back and forth to the port for a week, you know, helping out with some stuff. And I remember leaving the gate one day and my interpreter calling me like I'm halfway down from Lemanye to the port. And he's like, "Hey, don't go anywhere near the prison." I'm like, "Why?" He's like, "Well, nobody paid the guards this week. So they just tossed them all their guns and left the gates open last night." I'm like, I'm like, and by the time I hear this, I'm two blocks from passing by the prison.
Oh my
like,
God.
This is either going to go really smoothly or it's not going to go at all. But it's like, but that's just the thing. It's like that's in crazy. Certain places, it's this, you know, this that's is right. how close you are to chaos and
thin line. Yeah.
Yeah. Some people just don't want to see it. Okay. Don't see it, but you're going to end up in history books on the wrong side. Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's like you just said, I don't want to give away too much, but the amount of plots, like when I'm reading your book and I'm trying to figure out all the different ways, like you say, we get into that noir piece where everybody starts turning on each other. I'm like, as I'm thinking about it, I'm like, how, like, what does your battle board look like when you're mapping out Peacock and the Sparrow? Because you build and build, and then all of a sudden, to me, the wires of plot and character just start going whoop, and they just start crisscrossing and turn into a knot.
Yeah.
So no, how do you track that?
I don't know. That's a good question, because I think I knew the beginning, I knew the end. I didn't quite know all the stepping stones in between. I kind of just figured it out as I went. I knew, you know, I wanted this aging spy who was going to be caught between the two sides, and each side was going to be sort of trying to co-opt him, you know, and he would have to make a decision at the end. You know, I don't even know. I think at the end, it kind of just came together. I don't outline. I don't know if you do, but I don't. So I kind of keep this long page of this long document of notes that I haphazardly refer to. Mm-hmm. And that's about it. I mostly just keep it all in my brain and somehow it comes out at the end. I don't know. Yeah,
Yes. I am. I'm weird because, like you said, I got to have a hook and I got to have an ending. So I need to know where I'm going.
Yeah.
And then I will outline. Some of my outlines will be like 30 pages and I'll finish it and I'll put it all into like Scrivener. I'll set my chapters and I will never look at that outline again. I'll start writing. And it's like every day when writing session's done, I hit pause in the movie and then I come back to my next writing session and hit play and I just go. So I'll seldom go back to my original outline. It's weird.
But probably writing it, put it into your head. Probably.
Yeah. Just programs it in.
Yeah. Right. I mean, probably the act of writing it, you know, helps you.
Yeah, it's something, because it's like, man, I'd spent all this time filling up a notebook and I haven't opened it in like months.
Yeah, it's there in your brain, probably.
Yeah, it's there. But yeah, the you guys who can just go, like, I forget who, I think I was talking to Mike Bachman the other day, and he was just like, yeah, I had this question. It's like, what if this happened? And he's like, yeah, it was Mike. I was talking to him about, he's a horror writer, wrote Fantastic Land about, you know, Lord of the Flies, basically in a theme park. Mm-hmm. And he's like, yeah, I was at Disney with my kid one day. And I was like, what would happen if this all went to shit? And he's like, I wrote a book about it. I'm like, that's it. Like, that's your plan. That's all I needed. I'm like, okay.
That's awesome.
And it's a great book. It's, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's not me. Like, I got a plan. I need a plan.
Yeah.
Yep. So with Peacock and the Sparrow, was that a plan? Like, are you one of those kids who grew up with a notebook in your hand, or was it something that came on a little later?
For sure, I was always a writer. Like, I wrote constantly. I kept journals. I had about a million failed attempts at novels. I don't think I ever thought I could make writing a career. I mean, it's not a very lucrative career. Yeah. So I know. So, you know, I always went the track of being able to support myself. So I worked as a spy, which isn't the most practical career, but it was interesting. And then as a lawyer a little bit. But then it was only when I got back from Bahrain, and my son was about three at that point, and he went to preschool for the first time. So I had like, you know, 2 hours of the day to myself. And that was also the time when, you know, a lot of my experiences as a spy, they'd kind of been sort of percolating in my brain. A lot of kind of unanswered questions and things that haunted me. I mentioned some of them, and Baghdad was tough and it never really left me. And I had all these kind of experiences rattling around. And then I'd been to Bahrain, which I thought was so fascinating. And I thought that should be my setting because it's so interesting. I wanted to write about spying, and that was the setting that I wanted to use.
It's a fantastic place. Yeah.
I think it's interesting, and nobody has written about Bahrain. In fact, I think somebody, there's a group called Spybrary. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but but someone posed the question whether there had ever been a spy novel written in Bahrain, and no one could think of one. So it might be the only one. I don't know. But either way, I feel like there hasn't been a lot written about the Arab Spring in general. Mm. So I thought that was really, it all kind of came together. That was the right setting for me. And that's when I decided to kind of sit down and write in earnest. It was always my dream to be a writer, but you know, takes a while to kind of fulfill your dream. And I wouldn't have had anything to write about all these kind of stunted attempts at novels over the years. I mean, I think I was decent at writing, but I didn't have a good story to tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I had the same problem. I've carried a notebook around with me since I was about 12, and really? It took me till I was 36 to actually put something together on a page. And looking back on it, I'm like, I wonder if I just went and took this career that I've had just so I could come up with stuff to write about.
Right? I mean, I know. That's the thing. It all seems to kind of lead up to that point. You know, when I look back, I'm like, thank God I was a spy, because now this is what I write about. But exactly. Right. Perspective.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say you get a certain perspective and maturity as you get older that allows you to make sense of your experiences in a way that you couldn't when you were younger.
Yeah, and be able to articulate them. Yes. Like it's I remember, like you said, a million failed novel ideas in college. And I would look back at it, I'm like, what would I have even said
exactly
while I was in college would have had any substance whatsoever?
Like, exactly.
Yeah. I know, like, exactly. This is how you chug a beer. Like,
I know. I wrote this really short piece recently about how I, right after college, I moved to Prague. This was in the 90s. And it was like, I know, right? It's a great city. And it was like the Left Bank at the time. It was like the new Left Bank where everyone went if you wanted to write a novel. That was like the bohemian, you know, beatnik place to go. And so I packed up everything I had. I moved to Prague. I lived above this crappy nightclub called the Roxy. Because I had no money at all.
That's great.
And I know it was fun. And I worked for like a startup company, but I was determined. I was like, I am going to write the great, you know, expat novel. And I tried so hard, and I would go home every night. I had my journal and I would start writing, but it was like, I had nothing to say, you know, I would just write about Prague, but I didn't have a story. Yeah.
Yeah. And Prague, man, just walking around that city at night, especially just it seemed like every corner and every alley and every building has about 100,000 words that you can just stand in front of. And it's like, there is some cool stuff that's happened in this city.
Exactly.
I think of myself in my 20s, I've been like, I would have been an idiot, like, I don't know, catch it on fire and then, you know, jump out of the window and look cool doing it. I don't even, like, it would have been nothing. It would have, you know, just.
One of the things I wrote in this piece was how Prague in the 90s is now famous for having produced no notable literature at all.
Well, there was an amazing cinematic feat called Triple X that ended in Prague. Vin Diesel delivered. Like an electric performance. I think it was Prague.
But this is you're talking about a movie?
Yeah, it was all sarcasm, by the way. It was complete sarcasm. In my 20s, that's probably what I would have come up with, a B action movie.
Okay.
That's just it. Yeah, I look back on it now, like, it would have been as bad as those notebooks are filled up with really bad ideas, and they should stay that way.
You know? Yeah. But I mean, it's part of the process. I feel like you gotta go through it, you know. And I've also, you know, I was, when my book came out and I started going to these like Thriller Fest or VoucherCon and meeting other writers, I thought I'm going to be so old, you know, I thought, oh my God, I'm in my 40s with my first book. Like, you know, there must be, most people must be in their 20s or, but no, I mean, it's people my age, debut authors. And that was so heartening to me. You know, I was so glad to see that this is the norm, I think.
Yeah. And, yeah, just looking at that, but yeah, like if you look at the classics, like the, I call them classics, but for me, Clancy, Crichton, Vince Flynn, all those guys, that they didn't get going until mid 40s at the earliest. I mean, if you look at them, but yeah, I think the average age, what is the average age of like the person who can put something on the page is like mid 40s, early 50s, I think. Cause I think you're absolutely right. Yeah.
But it was so encouraging to me. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not the rookie. Well, I'm a rookie, but I'm not a young rookie.
Right.
Right. Yep. Yeah. It's, I do love going to book conferences though. You know, just mix it up. I haven't done Thriller Fest. When I was looking at Thriller Fest, it was right when COVID hit and I'm like, I'm not doing a virtual book conference.
Yeah.
And same thing, kind of life got in the way. I'm going to go to VoucherCon this year and I'm going to try and do Thriller Fest next year. But prior to that, it's been all the like reader focused conventions, like smaller stuff. But I love just mixing it up with readers, just getting to talk books for like a week straight is something we don't get to do in our normal life.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I didn't even know that world existed before I was published. I mean, to me, that's by far the best part of the process has been meeting other writers. I mean, I think the community is so welcoming, so supportive, unlike any profession I've ever been in.
That was one of the biggest takeaways, was just you know, because I'm like, I'm nobody. I've had a couple small publishers. I much prefer being an independent. As of like this year, I was just like, I'm done. So I like having the control of doing it myself. But you know, it could be me talking to, you know, name your bestseller, my New York Times bestseller right here. Like, you know, I could be in,
I'm not,
you know,
a New York Times bestseller, but I appreciate the vote.
But you're up there. You're up there. You know, with a big five deal, like, you know, and we'll talk and you're more than happy to come chat with me for an hour. It's you know, it's awesome. But yeah, you're absolutely right. In any other profession you're at, they'd just be like, what's your angle?
I just feel like writers lift each other up. You know, it's not competitive. And that was shocking to me that, because I've never been, I mean, I was a lawyer, I was a spy. Those were not professions where you're absolutely bending over backwards to support the people next to you. You would think maybe a spy, but not. But it's not really
Yeah, in government, it's not always like that. I mean, you'll get those pockets of people that, you know, you can depend on, but you know, you go outside your little pocket and you're like, I'm going to put my shock plate to my back because I know the knives are coming.
Exactly.
Just the way it is. Yeah. But yeah, it's everybody wants to work together and everybody just comes to it with understanding that, you know, the mutual support ensures mutual success, which is it's alien to me, but I really like it.
Same. Yep. Totally.
It's just very cool. There was something that's been bothering me. We got off on this tangent, which is a really good one. Going back to Bahrain. I just, when you were talking about your expat characters in your book, and I'm thinking, you're over in Bahrain as a dependent.
Yes.
You've been a spy in a wartime setting.
Yeah.
How are you at dinner parties? Like,
not popular. Well, I mean, this is true. I mean, I was not popular in the sense that I took such an interest in the country. I was really like, my son was a toddler at the time and I would take him sightseeing. We would go to the slums. We'd go to the Tree of Life. We would go to, you know, all the places I wrote about in my book. I really wanted to get immersed in the country. I was really interested in the politics. I would want to discuss the politics, and none of the other expat, mostly wives, because they were mostly dependents like me, but they didn't want to talk about it. It was like hush hush. And we would go to parties and I'd be like, oh, what do you think of what the monarchy just did? And everyone would like give me dirty looks and you can't talk about that. And which I kind of tried to portray in my book. I think people thought I was sort of the odd woman out, because I'd had this background where I was really immersed in foreign affairs and wanted more of the same in Bahrain. And I think a lot of the expats were kind of just there to live in the big villas with their live-in housekeepers and their hired lawnmowers and, you know, people to mow the lawn. And so it wasn't a great fit.
I just wonder, because depending on the setting, like my wife will like give me the admonishment in the car, be like, just, you're not as funny as you think you are. Your dark humor doesn't play here. Just be a nice boy and sit in the corner. Like, so I could just see you coming up with like some story from Baghdad and be like, you guys are going to love this. And just everybody's face just dropping.
You know what? People were like, you know, I was just a mom and a wife there. Like, I don't even think people knew about, I mean, they did a little bit, but I don't know. They just, that wasn't really how I defined myself there. I mean, until my book was published, between the time I left the agency and the time my book was published, you know, the CIA wasn't a big part of my conversations. Like now it is, because I wrote a spy novel and it's really based on my experiences to some degree. And but for years, you know, when you have a kid, I mean, your life is like play dates and right. school and, yep. you know, what's for dinner. Yeah. And yeah.
Priorities shift. My kid showed up, my entire life took a 100% right turn.
Yeah.
It was like, all the rest of that stuff just didn't matter anymore. It's just being a dad is the best part.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Every now and then I'd say, you know, oh yeah. Like, well, when I was a spy and people would kind of look at me, like, I think they thought I was just throwing that out there or making it up or I don't know what, but I was like, no, really I was. It's like, oh, yeah,
I was just wondering if the dark humor followed, because it's entertaining to me anytime like the, you know, people from that world like mix it up with different groups, and it's like, oh, this is sooner or later it's going to get awkward because somebody's going to say a joke that's very off color.
Yeah.
that would work really well in the office, does not work at all here. Right.
Yeah. Well, the other thing too, though, you'll appreciate because of DC, is that so many people here, if they're not spies, they're something close. they're like an analyst for the CIA or they work for DOD. So, you know, being a spy isn't quite as anomalous and sexy here as it is elsewhere.
It's just going to work. It's just another day.
Right.
Right. Yeah. That is true. Excuse me. Okay. I told you, I warned you. I might have a coughing fit. I just saved it. Just saved it. Going back to, I did have a note. Yeah. Okay. So this note, just, it's an odd one, but I'm going through my notes that I had in your margins and getting back to Collins.
Yeah.
I'm not giving away, like we talked about earlier. I'm not that there's that fine line of spoilers and points that you really want to talk about, cause it's just fun to talk to the person whose mind this came from. But I just want to see what you think of this, my note here. I start referring to Shane. I started out thinking he was just like a war weary detective / spy, just a world on his shoulders.
Yeah.
And at the end, thinking of him and reviewing the book, he makes my skin crawl a little bit.
Hmm.
And I'm just like, there's part of me is like, that dude screwed up real bad. And then there's another part of me is like, the dude was doing his job. He got distracted and it was human.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't call him a bad guy. Like,
right.
I don't think there were any good guys. I don't know. He left me with a weird feeling that I don't, usually I can say he's wearing a white hat, he's wearing a black hat. And Shane, I'm just like, I don't know what that's he's wearing.
No, yeah. I love that. I think, you nailed it. I think that's what I tried to do. I mean, that there aren't clear good and bad guys or clear right and wrong sides in espionage or in the Arab Spring. And I tried to have my characters reflect that. I mean, as you said, none of the characters is really clearly good, clearly bad. I think Whitney's a mixed bag. You know, Whitney in his own way tries to do the right thing and he ends up being a victim, in different ways, but he's not particularly likable either. And same with Almaisa. And she has, I think she's sympathetic in some ways. She had a traumatic childhood and, you know, she has a traumatic story with her parents in the book. And, you know, she's part of this, this movement, I think, that, that the Arab Spring, that's very sympathetic. But in the end, of course, maybe she's not as sympathetic as you thought she was. And same with Collins. And, I mean, yeah, I intended for Collins to really be a complex, mixed character who you don't know if you're, if you like him or not, you don't know if he's good or bad. And he's kind of a blend of both. And I think he, for me, I tend to see more the good in him, maybe because I wrote the character. And I think that's honestly one of the joys and virtues of writing, is that I think it builds a kind of empathy with people who aren't like you. Like I don't think I'm very much like Collins. And yet, you know, I tried to live in his head for like the 5 years that it took me to write the book. So I feel like here was a guy who also had a kind of traumatic past, childhood, who in his own way he'd been battered by the profession of espionage for 20 some years, and in his own way was trying to do the right thing in a clumsy, misguided way at times, but ultimately trying to do the right thing. And I think there's a tension, at least I tried throughout the book to build this tension between what he wants to be and what he is, you know, that he constantly is trying to convince himself that he did the right things and to justify his actions, and he can't quite get there, you know?
That's why what it came down to was I can't quite call him a bad guy, 'cause I feel like he's a product of, like you say, all his baggage made him what he is. Yeah. But I also felt the conflict of, you know, his 28 year old self just graduating the farm would make wildly different decisions.
Yeah.
Than, you know, whatever, 45, 50 years old that he is now with all that. Yeah. So that's what got me. 'Cause you can see, I mean, life wears on people, and he's doing his job as far as he sees it with the problems that he has accumulated over the career. So that's it. Left me, most characters, like I say, most characters I get a feel for, but when I got to the end of the book with him, I'm just like, I don't know if I want to have a beer with you, but I don't think I'm ready to call you a villain.
I'm glad you felt like that. I mean, that was really my goal.
It was awesome.
And thank you. And a lot of my literary influences, a lot of the books that I really admired had characters like that. I was always drawn to the really complex, semi-likable or semi-unlikable characters. I always mention An American Tragedy by Theodore Dreiser. I don't know if you read it, Theodore.
I'm not as well read as I should be.
No one's read that book. Nobody at all has read that book. I read like really obscure classics. And,
nice.
Didn't read a lot of thrillers until I became a thriller writer, but
it pays off.
But he also wrote Sister Carrie, which also had a really unlikable protagonist, but also kind of mixed. But in An American Tragedy, I really recommend the book. It's long, but it's this young man, this young boy who grows up with this kind of underprivileged upbringing, and he wants so desperately. I mean, he's poor, and I think he's in this kind of like religious cult type family, and he breaks free, and he's kind of seduced. He wants so desperately to be part of the American dream and to work his way up in society and to be prosperous and happy, and he'll do anything for that. And it ends up with a really tragic ending. I won't give it away, but he does really horrible things along the way, really horrible things, like much worse than what Collins does. And yet at the end, I mean, I still remember it. I don't want to give away the ending, but you're still rooting for him at the end. I mean, this guy who does these horrible things. But I think that, to me, when I read that book, I'm like, wow, this is what makes it a great book, is that somehow you're still rooting for this guy that by all rights, you should not be rooting for.
Yeah. And those are the best kind of, it's like I said earlier, brings me back to Elroy, you know, in LA Confidential, Bud ends up being the purest character of them all, but he's the most vicious when we start out the book, and everybody else around him is five levels shadier than this guy was. Yeah. And this guy starts out as the monster. And it's some books just get you, and it's all character driven. You nailed it. I loved it. I can't wait. What do you got coming next?
So I pivoted on my next book, and it's actually set against the Gaza conflict, which might be, I know people have strong feelings about it. I don't know. I haven't figured it all out, but I just think writers should not shy away from the hard issues. And I think it's such an interesting, important conflict that it just inspired me to write about it. So it's another spy novel, and it's a little bit of a kind of reverse Little Drummer Girl. I don't know if you've read Little Drummer Girl by Le Carré.
No.
It's my favorite Le Carré book. Not most people's favorite, but my favorite. And it's basically the story of the Mossad recruiting a young British woman to try to penetrate a terrorist group for an assassination. Which is, as I think, as topical now as it was when he wrote it. And it's just brilliantly done. So mine's a little bit of a reverse in that there's an American female case officer handling a source to try to penetrate Hamas for a joint Mossad-CIA assassination operation.
That kind of infiltration piece, like in my world, the deep undercover assignment was always to me like something I knew I could not do. I didn't have the personality to do it, to sell it, or the confidence to go that far out without a net. That's the stuff that could make my spine tingle faster than pretty much anything else. It's crazy. And it,
I hear you. Well, it's, yeah.
I don't know.
I'm the same way.
Looking forward to that one.
We'll
awesome. Well, I told you I wouldn't keep you much more than an hour, but I do have one final question that comes up with everybody who's had that servant life and your time serving the government in some very dangerous places. Same question everybody gets: first responder, intelligence, veteran. Run into an 18-year-old kid. Gets out of high school, doesn't know what to do with their life, thinking, private sector, government service. What's your advice? Oh, intelligence world. We'll go intelligence world.
No, I mean, I love government. I mean, I'm always an advocate for government service. I think we need more people in government. We need good people. And the other thing is, if you're right out of high school, you said,
give or take. I mean, trying to figure out what to do with your life.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like for someone young who's trying to figure out what to do with their lives, I think the military is a great place. I wasn't in the military; my husband was, but I worked as a civilian as an intel analyst for Department of Defense, and I just think the military does such a great job of training you and educating you. It's such a springboard. I mean, I think it sets you up with these skills for life. So I just think, I mean, of those three options, someone right out of high school, not knowing what to do, I say, do the military.
That's it. Yeah. For me, I'm already working on my 11-year-old trying to get him to join the Coast Guard.
Oh, okay.
He's much smarter than I am or was at his age, and he's 11. So he's probably going to have a much better idea for himself. But if I go back to what I was in high school, I should have gone and served in the military. Cause I would have, you take that time, figure out what you want to do before you come back, devote yourself to 4 years of a degree you're probably not going to use. Right. So that's, but when it comes down to it, I think like you said, government service, I think it's a different life that you get a whole lot out of at the end of the day. There's a lot that can be said for serving your country and whatever mode that is. So I agree with you 100%. And the better people we have in government, the better off we're all going to be.
Yeah. And even if it's not, I mean, like for me, the agency wasn't a great fit. I did love my job at DOD. So I did love government service. The agency wasn't such a great fit for me, but I wouldn't trade that for anything. I mean, it was, and even having nothing to do with me being a writer, just the experience itself. I mean, I'm really proud of my service, and I feel honored to have done it. So.
Well, thank you. I think that's a fantastic answer, and thank you very much for doing that. I mean, that's some scary stuff. I mean, I had a beer at your guys' little palace that you had in the Green Zone. So that was pretty nice. What was that?
Babylon Bar. Is that what it was?
I made it out there for an evening. I actually showed up one day to your. I had to run something up to the office at the Neck, and as I knock on the door, a dude answers the door, and I'm like, it was a buddy of mine who was a former cop in DC who moved over, and I was like, what are you doing in Iraq? He's like, what are you doing in Iraq? I was like, oh, let's go get a drink. Like, government service, man, friends in weird places.
Yeah, for sure.
Thank you very much for joining me tonight. Absolutely, and you're welcome back anytime you want. I've got isberry.net for a website, and Twitter and Instagram. Keep it consistent with @isberryauthor.
Correct. You got it.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. And like I said, anytime you want to come back, please do.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Absolutely. All right. Good night, everybody.